This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today, our TV critic David Bianculli is going to talk about the best TV shows of the year, and film critic David Edelstein is going to talk about the best movies. They both have their 10 best lists. Let's start with David Edelstein and the year in movies. Hi, David. Thank you for bringing your 10 best list with you again this year. And I'm sure that, like most years, your 10 best list has more than 10 films on it.
It does. I thought it was an excellent year. And as usual, even though I could only see maybe 400 out of like the 1,000 movies that got released in New York and L.A., I had enough to fill a couple of 10 best lists. And I have this year a dozen best films. So if I may?
Yes. You want to start from the bottom to the top?
Well, sure. Coming in at 11 and 12 are two films, the deadpan German comedy Tony Erdmann, which opens very soon, and Jeff Nichols' Loving, which is the story of the couple that inspired the abolition of miscegenation laws in many states. Three documentaries, The Witness, which focuses on the true facts concerning the death of Kitty Genovese in 1964 through the eyes of her brother, Tower, an animated reenactment of the random University of Texas at Austin shootings of 1966, and Zero Days, yet another masterly Alex Gibney documentary, and maybe his most urgent since it's about cyber warfare. The Handmaiden is next. That's Park Chan-wook's Korean transplant of Sarah Waters' lesbian novel Fingersmith, which is so elegant and so perverse. Coming in at number six is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, which is an exploration of racial and sexual identity. It seems almost too delicate to bruise with hype, but it's just lovely. Number five is another documentary. It's O.J. Made in America, which was also made for TV, but it was shown in enough theaters to qualify. And given the scale of its ambition and its achievement, Ezra Edelman's film would have been hard not to recognize. Number four is the debut of the year, Krisha. It's Trey Edward Schultz's micro-budget Thanksgiving family reunion movie starring members of his own family, and it's a virtuoso symphony of bad vibes. Number three is 20th Century Women by Mike Mills, with Annette Bening giving the performance of her life, I'm not sure praise could be any higher, as an overbearing single mother in the 1970s. For me, it was tough. It was a tough choice between my second and first film. Coming in at number two is Hell or High Water, which is a absolutely haunting modern Western with Chris Pine and Ben Foster as bank-robbing brothers and Jeff Bridges as the sheriff on their trail. My number one movie is La La Land, which is Damien Chazelle's romantic musical with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, in which everything, the movement of the camera, the colors of the set and the costumes, the rhythms of the actors, harmonizes with everything else. And this year, we need us some harmony.
I really love that movie, La La Land. And I'm, as somebody who loves musicals, I'm really grateful to have a new musical that pays homage to early musicals, but is also firmly a contemporary one. It's just a wonderful film.
I could not agree more. It's got that wonderful fantasy land, well, La La Land feel and tempo, but at the same time, it really does get into somewhat grittier, you know, more traumatic kinds of conflicts. It's a beautiful combination of an homage to the past and something entirely new. You know, I saw Damien Chazelle's first movie, which is called Guy and Madeline, on a park bench some years ago. He seemed like he was just out of college. I saw it at a New Jersey Film Society. There was a long final solo by the main character, a trumpet player, and it went on and on and on. But I thought I'd never seen a director who dared so much to find access to human emotion through making music. And I just knew, and then Whiplash came next, and I knew this guy was going to go places.
So who did you think turned in some of the best performances of the year?
Well, I said Annette Bening.
She's wonderful in that film.
You know, she's like about my favorite actress now. To me, there is just nobody who is more present, who can think on screen, who seems to be, every word that comes out of her mouth seems to be her own. And Mike Mills has given her such a rich part here. It's an extraordinary role. It's an extraordinary performance. There are others in that movie. Greta Gerwig is quite fine. And
Elle Fanning.
And just a wonderful, wonderful film. Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are so inhumanly gorgeous. And the fact that they go so well together. And look, you know, he's got a very thin voice but it's very pleasing somehow all the same. And they're not great dancers, but somehow or other, when you put all the ingredients together and they do it in one take, and you have these lovely songs by Justin Hurwitz, the movie is magic. I mean, the parts are great, and the whole movie is even greater than the sum of its parts. I want to say a word about Sarah Paulson. She's gotten obviously a lot of acclaim for her performance as Marcia Clark on television. But there's a small, interesting film called Blue Jay. It's really a two-person film, a duet with Mark Duplass, who also wrote the film. And the range of emotions on her face is just so dizzying. I want to mention Ben Foster and Chris Pine in Hell or High Water. I want to mention a Chilean actress named Paulina Garcia in Ira Sachs's film Little Men. Michael Shannon is a blast in Nocturnal Animals, the Tom Ford movie about which I'm very ambivalent. But Shannon is just creepy as hell and wonderful and charismatic. Amy Adams gives two wonderful performances in Nocturnal Animals and Arrival. She's a very interesting actress to me because I kind of intuit something frightened and damaged in her, that I feel as if it's, you know, being sort of dragged into the light before your eyes in some of her performances. She's awfully good in these movies.
So, David, you ran through your best of list, some great films on there. And, you know, here's what I'm thinking. So many Americans are so obsessed with politics right now and have been for months, you know, during the primaries, during the election, and now in the president-elect Trump era. And the nation's very divided. Both sides of that divide, I think, are very obsessed with what's going on in politics. Movies are usually a little slow to register what's going on politically and culturally because it takes so long to get them made and to get the funding to distribute them. So I'm wondering if you've been feeling a disconnect at all between the American obsession and what's actually happening on screen right now.
Absolutely. It's funny, even documentaries, which are so much more of the moment, are lagging behind. And, you know, you can't really expect bloggers and even the best journalists to give us the long view to help us process these things the way, you know, great artists can. You can't think about the year in film in a vacuum. Right now, if you look at our screens, there are a lot of smart and humanistic and multicultural movies out there that don't capture at least part of the nation's mood.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us, David. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Terry.
David Edelstein is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine. Now let's hear from our critic at large, John Powers. He says there are so many interesting movies, TV shows, and books these days that he just doesn't get around to talking about them all. Now that 2016's ending, he wants to tell you about some things he loved this year but didn't get a chance to review. Here's John.
It's the great pleasure of my work that I get to spend my days watching and reading. It's the great frustration that every year I'm haunted by all the terrific things I haven't talked about on Fresh Air. I call this collection of things my ghost file, and as 2016 comes to an end, I want to unhaunt myself by sharing six of my favorite ghosts. They range from the cosmic to the comic. Filmmaking doesn't come much more cosmically ambitious than Krzysztof Kieślowski's 1989 Decalogue, one of the towering cinematic achievements of the last half century, which was finally released on DVD and Blu-ray. Each of its 10-hour-long films takes place in an unlovely Polish housing block and tells a story that offers a modern look at one of the Ten Commandments. For instance, Thou Shalt Not Have Other Gods Before Me centers on a man who worships science, then must confront personal tragedy in a world he believes to be godless. brilliantly made and often shattering, Kieslowski's masterwork is about nothing less than the nature of morality and the human soul. The spiritual stakes are equally high in The Vegetarian by the South Korean novelist Han Gong. It tells the mesmerizing story of Yong-hae, a seemingly ordinary housewife who, after a disturbing dream, decides to quit eating meat. This decision sounds simple enough, but it unleashes crazy consequences in every direction, shattering her family, offending the patriarchy, inspiring an erotic film, and driving Yong-hae to seek to transcend her own flesh and blood body. When I tried to review The Vegetarian back in January, this unsettling fever dream of a novel was so simple and yet so surreal, I couldn't figure out how to do it justice without spoiling it. Since then, Gong and her book went on to win the Man Booker International Prize. And rightly so. This is one novel you won't forget. You find an alienated heroine of a very different sort in Fleabag, a salaciously funny, strangely touching British TV series available on Amazon. Written by and starring the lanky, lovely Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the show centers on a wisecracking cafe owner called Fleabag, who struggles with being young and single in London. Fleabag's messy life includes her floundering business, her headlong bedhopping, her Machiavellian stepmother, her hyper-successful sister, and making things even trickier, her own desire to be a good feminist. Here, late in a miserable night, the despondent Fleabag bangs on the front door of her father, an emotionally distant man, played by Bill Paterson.
All right, Dad?
What's going on?
Oh, I'm absolutely fine.
Okay.
I just,
Yeah?
That's nothing. It doesn't.
You know, it's nearly 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I have a horrible feeling that I'm a greedy, perverted, selfish, apathetic, cynical, depraved, morally bankrupt woman who can't even call herself a feminist.
Spiky and smart, Fleabag works cultural terrain first staked out by Lena Dunham's Girls. But Waller-Bridge takes the conflicting pressures of modern womanhood in a direction all her own. So does Search Party from TBS, which is one of the year's best new shows. It stars Arrested Development's wonderful curly-haired Aaliyah Shawkat as Dory, a dazed post-collegiate Brooklynite with a lousy job, vacuously self-absorbed friends, and a boyfriend so annoying you want to clobber him. Likeable but lost, Dory doesn't know what she wants. But when she spots a poster about a college classmate who's gone missing, she grows obsessed with finding her, although it's pretty clear she's actually searching for herself. Even as it sympathetically follows Dory's quest, the show offers a funny, bracingly nasty portrait of our narcissistic culture, in which direct human feeling is replaced by snark, social media, and iPhone photos of strangers fighting on the street. Still, Fleabag and Search Party seem benign compared to the addictive mystery and suspense novels of Margaret Millar, who died in 1994. Nine of her best books are included in the first two volumes of Collected Millar from the Soho Syndicate, and boy is she good. Millar's mysteries are filled with clever twists, yet what makes them special is her surgical approach to her characters' inner lives. She's got an eagle eye for the juicy stuff lots of mystery writers still ignore. Questions of class, status, sexual desire, and the difficult position of women. This last was something she knew about firsthand. Millar's work was long overshadowed by that of her husband, detective novelist Ross MacDonald. In fact, her best novels, like 1955's Beast in View, have a ferocious edge that make him look rather tame. After so much darkness and alienation, I'm delighted to end by talking about Aquarius, the life-affirming new film by the superb Brazilian filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho that's currently playing around the country. Brazil's legendary Sônia Braga plays Clara, a widowed music writer who's the last remaining resident of a gorgeous old apartment building along the beach. A racist young real estate guy wants to replace it with a bigger one, but Clara refuses to sell. Aquarius is a movie about history and politics and how we deal with passing time. What brings it alive is Clara, who in Braga's deeply lived-in performance becomes something miraculous in today's movies. A woman in her mid-60s who's portrayed in all her rich, complicated fullness. We see her go out to clubs with her girlfriends, admit her maternal failings to her grown-up kids, drink wine and dance in her living room, make love with a handsome young boy toy, and fight the money men and politicos who want to chase her from her home. Aquarius may conclude my ghost file, but Clara is anything but a ghost. She's the most alive person in a movie positively brimming with life.
John Powers is TV and film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Now our TV critic, David Bianculli, has his 10 best list and a look back at the year in television. David is also the author of the new book, The Platinum Age of Television. Hi, David. Thank you for bringing your 10 best list with us. Before we talk about some of the larger trends of the year, could you just like read through your top 10?
Okay. We'll go bottom up, like number 10, and then work our way up because I guess it's more dramatic that way. Number 10 is Veep on HBO. Number 9 is Horace and Pete, which is not on TV at all, but you can get it on Louis C.K.'s website, louisck.net. Then next is Game of Thrones on HBO. Next is Shameless on Showtime. Next is Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on HBO. I thought he had a remarkable year. And then a trio of miniseries. There's The Night Manager on AMC. That was the one with Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie. And then The People versus O.J. Simpson on FX, which I put in a tie with a miniseries, nonfiction documentary series on ESPN, O.J. Made in America. Both of those were so much less exploitive and so much more informative and entertainment than I imagined going in. And then the top three, number three is The Night Of on HBO with John Turturro as a sort of down on his luck lawyer. Number two was Black Mirror, which came back on Netflix. Number one, Better Call Saul on AMC.
Yeah, I love Better Call Saul. When is it coming back? What happened?
It's coming back February, I think.
Oh, good.
It's coming back in just a couple of months.
Okay, very good, very good. Have you brought any clips from any of these you'd like to play for us?
Yes, I have. I brought one from The Night Of, and John Turturro stars as a lawyer who's not only down and out and down on his luck, but he's got eczema, I mean, to a seriously debilitating degree. You know, he wears gloves, he can't wear shoes, you know, and he's struggling through and he's usually dealing with the only sort of clients that would accept him. And here he's got a guy named Nas, and while going through most of the miniseries, not even getting to argue the case, he ends up having to do the closing summation. And it's just very touching.
So here's John Turturro.
What I normally do is plea my clients out, because 95% of the time they did what they were charged with. They sold that dope, they solicited that guy, they stole that iPhone. It's clear to me just looking at them. So I tell them, don't be stupid, take the deal. The first time I saw Naz, he was sitting alone in a holding cell at the 21st precinct. He'd just been arrested. I walked past him, out of the station, and then stopped. I turned around and went back. Why? Because I didn't see what I see in my other clients. And I still don't after all this time.
So that was John Turturro on The Night Of. So James Gandolfini was initially supposed to play that role, but he died before the series was shot.
Yes. Well, actually, the pilot was shot, except that that character is only in it for the very last scene, the scene that was described in the clip that we heard. And so there is that footage somewhere of Gandolfini acting in that one scene. I don't know whether they're going to release it on the DVD or not, but that was why they were able to have Turturro take it over, even though the rest of the pilot had already been shot.
I'd like to see that. So this was a good year for the miniseries. Three miniseries are on your top 10 list. So what does that say to you about the miniseries?
It says a lot. It says that what's happening to U.S. television is that it's adopting the British model more aggressively and doing shorter things that are self-contained. And the benefits to this are huge. You can get better actors, better writers, better directors that won't commit to a 5 or 7 year series. For viewers, you can get something that's more self-contained, that has an ending as well as a beginning. The only downside is that they can be harder to promote because they're just individual entities that show up and then they're gone. But in this way, it's how television began, with the golden age of TV and the anthology shows. Each week, you didn't know if you were going to get a Patterns or a Requiem for a Heavyweight, but you just trusted.
So running through your top 10, you mentioned that the People vs. O.J. Simpson was so much better than you thought it would be.
Yes.
What were you expecting?
I was expecting a lot more exploitation, a lot more everything we already knew, and sort of like an O.J. Simpson's greatest hits, as grisly as that sounds. Like, let's remember this, and let's remember this, and let's go just into this part of the testimony, and you'll get to Cato Kaelin, and you'll get to Mark Furman. But it did so much behind-the-scenes stuff, so much research, that it was fascinating.
Sarah Paulson's performance was so well received for that.
Yes, that was a remarkable performance and quite a revelation in terms of the way she played it and the things that we learned about her. And even the public scenes where people who followed the case at the time might remember have so much resonance. I brought a clip where it's a press conference immediately after the verdict is announced. And as shaken as she is, and a lot of people were at the time, she finds a way to make a stronger point.
Okay, here's Sarah Paulson.
I first want to extend my deepest thanks to the families of the victims, to the Goldmans and to the Browns. Their strength, their dignity, and their support throughout this trial has been a tremendous source of inspiration and strength to all of us. This case was fought as a battle for victims of domestic violence. We hope this verdict does not discourage the victims who are out there throughout this country from seeking help. I know there are women who are at this very moment living in fear, living in violence. Please, don't let this make you lose faith in our system.
That was Sarah Paulson in The People versus O.J. Simpson. With me is our TV critic, David Bean Cooley, and we're talking about the best TV of the year. So one of the things on your 10 best list, David, Horace and Pete, is a Louis C.K. series that he did just for his website.
I know.
And it was, what was it, a 10-part series?
I think it was 8, but...
But who's counting?
Yes, I know. But
It was such a big risk for him. I think he put up a lot of his own money.
And he dropped it like a Beyonce album. It's like, suddenly, here it is. I loved the ambition of it. And when you watch it, it's like, okay, yes, it's a comedy, but parts of it are very dark. It's like you're watching an O'Neill drama rolling out on a weekly basis. And I just think, as much as his TV series Louis on FX, which has been gone now for a couple of years, where he was an auteur, he's, you know, in this one, he's one of the co-stars, he's writing it. It really has a vision attached. And even the comic bits have an undercurrent. I was very satisfied with it and then blown away by the delivery system. This is like, you know, hey kids, let's put on a show for real.
Well, really dominating this year in television was politics. In so many ways. I mean, the debates, the constant coverage of the campaign and then the post-campaign. And because Donald Trump is from the world of reality television, he's certainly known how to use like TV and Twitter. So, David, since you've had to watch reality TV as part of your job as a TV critic, let's talk about The Apprentice for a moment, which not all of us have seen, even though it's been on a really long time and really popular. First of all, Donald Trump is going to continue to be executive producer of
apparently
the latest of the new edition of The Apprentice.
Yes, he is. The one that is now going to be hosted by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
So what does that mean just in terms of television? Like, leaving the ethics of this aside for a moment, do you have any idea what his role is going to be? And he works with Mark Burnett
Mark
on
Burnett,
this, right?
Yeah, who is,
describe that whole thing for us.
Mark Burnett is the executive producer who hit the holy grail with reality TV with Survivor. He's got a show I like very much that's on right now with The Voice. And, you know, he's got all of these other ones all going at the same time. And he went into business early on with Donald Trump on The Apprentice. And it was successful for NBC for several seasons. And for those who haven't seen it or didn't ever look at it for a long time, as the series went on, you know, there would always be celebrity contestants, semi-celebrity contestants, who the hell are these people contestants all put together. And every week one of them would get eliminated by Donald Trump, whose word and decision were final. But he always had one or two people sitting at his right or left that were advising him. And in later seasons, these would include his son and his daughter. So we have seen them in a managerial or advisory capacity already. They would be sent out to check and see how the celebrities were doing, building their lemonade stands on Park Avenue or whatever the stunt was for the week. And that would keep going. But, you know, I go back to Survivor, the one that really kicked off the reality trend in this century. And what Mark Burnett did there is, to me, very instructive to what happened to us politically and how Donald Trump may have played himself as a candidate. Because the first Survivor had Richard Hatch, who was sort of like the villain of the piece, because he was manipulating the rules as they were laid out in order to win, and he kept winning. The way that he was doing it was because he was more entertaining to people watching, so he was kept on while other people were not.
Even though he was breaking the rules.
He was either breaking the rules or he was just being more abrasive. He was not being a team player. He was not the ideal candidate. He was not the person to whom you would want to win the $1 million. But he got all the way to the final. And then when you figure that's when he's going to lose and right is going to triumph, instead, the people who had the vote to decide who the winner was going to be decided that he had worked the rules better than anybody else and he deserved the win. So Richard Hatch won the first Survivor. And so if you think of this last election as any sort of reality TV because of one of the candidates coming from there, we got pretty much the same thing. I'm not saying Donald Trump is evil. I'm saying that he got so much media attention early on and throughout because he was more entertaining. The mainstream media gave him so much free press to express his opinions and to stoke the fires of publicity or outrage or anything else that they kept him in the game even though this wasn't a game.
David, part of this year was pretty rough for you because you were in the hospital for a while. You needed surgery. So the germane part of this for our talk today is, what did you watch on TV while you were in the hospital?
I was in there for a month, and I would have watched. My default station is usually Turner Classic Movies, and it would have been perfect in the hospital, except the hospital at which I stayed, didn't have TCM. I'm going to have to check in the emergency room from now on. That's going to be one of the questions. It's like, all right, I don't care about MTV. Do you have TCM?
So what did you watch?
I watched the show that gave me the most comfort was reruns wherever I could find them of The Andy Griffith Show, and actually gave me solace when I was in pain.
Because that show meant a lot to you when you were a kid, when you were growing up. And we talked about that the last time you were on.
Yeah, there's something about it. It made me happy. And I guess it was the TV equivalent of comfort food. And otherwise, I just wanted to watch things that would take a long time to be over so they would distract me. So I watched a lot of baseball. I watched a lot of politics and just kept going.
You mentioned how much you wished your hospital had Turner Classic Movies.
Yes.
So when my mother-in-law, before she died, was in the hospital and was in kind of a coma. You know how a lot of people say sometimes people in coma can actually hear what's being said, though mm-hmm. they can't acknowledge it? Mm-hmm. The nurse suggested that when we weren't there with her, that we put on Turner Classic Movies, and that a lot of those movies were from, you know, my mother-in-law's era. And that maybe she'd hear them and enjoy what she was hearing, or just like it would reach her in some emotional way and she'd find something to connect to in the actual world. And I thought, what a wise and beautiful idea. So that's what we did.
That is a great idea. I mean, hospitals, nursing homes, I hope you're listening.
Yeah, really. Well, David, I wish you a great 2017.
Oh, thanks. You as well.
Thank you very much. It's always fun to talk with you.
I love this end-of-year debriefing.
David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. He teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey and is the founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching. Now our rock critic Ken Tucker is going to tell us about his list of the 10 best recordings of the year. But first, he's going to pay tribute to some of the musicians we lost in 2016, starting with Leon Russell, who died in November.
Any summation of the year in music for 2016 becomes a roll call for the dead. It seems as though there's been a startling increase in the number of important music makers who've passed away. Some of these deaths were shocks in various ways. We had no idea, for example, so soon after the release of his very good album Black Star, that David Bowie would die. When I reviewed Leonard Cohen's album of new songs, You Want It Darker, at the end of October, I said that its spiritually meditative music was like a living will. His age suggested that death might be imminent, but I couldn't know he'd die within days of the airing of that review. The death of Prince seemed to momentarily shake the earth. How could a musician so vital, so present, so witty, just vanish from daily existence? I know I'm not going to get to everyone, but other significant artists who died this year included Sharon Jones and Leon Russell, A Tribe Called Quest's Fife Dog and the Eagles' Glenn Frey, Maurice White, and Merle Haggard.
Down every road, there's always one more city. I'm on the run, the highway is
lot of cane back in my younger days. While Mama used to pray my crops would fail. Now I'm a hunted fugitive with just two ways. I'd run the law or spend my life in jail.
Turning to the living, I had no trouble coming up with 10 albums whose music provided me with reasons to be hopeful in a troubled year. There was amazing ambition on display from both Beyoncé and Miranda Lambert. Beyoncé's Lemonade wasn't just an album, it was a multimedia event full of power and assertiveness. Miranda Lambert filled the 24 songs on The Weight of These Wings with a passion that was often heartbreaking. And speaking of heartache, it spilled over the edges of William Bell's remarkable comeback album, This Is Where I Live.
I was born in Memphis in a different world. Now that time has come and gone. I was just a little boy when I heard Sam Cooke singing, a change is gonna come. It touched my soul. Let me know there's a promise of a brand new day. Then I left my home, started out on my own. This is where I live. This is where I live. This is where I give all my love, all my time, all my money, every dime. This is where
I put two debut albums on my year-end top 10. The first is Margaret Glaspie's deceptively direct Emotions and Math. The second is by the I Don't Cares, which is really a new act from two familiar voices, Paul Westerberg and Juliana Hatfield. For the life of me, I cannot figure out why their slashing yet playful album Wild Stab didn't make more of a splash. Kelsey Walden's hardcore country album, I've Got a Way, was a model of throwback music that avoided nostalgia. I admired greatly the gritty yet alluring rhythm and blues of Maxwell's Black Summer's Night and the hard-charging ambition of Car Seat Headrest's Teens of Denial. Finally, two longtime favorites made my year-end list. Robbie Fulks's Upland Stories was a frequently magnificent achievement, full of novelistically detailed compositions about how the world can let you down. And Bonnie Raitt's Dig In Deep did just what its title said. It bore down hard on the idea that people frequently try to be better than they are and come up short. All in all, it was a sad year for music and an exhilarating one. New avenues of expression opened up for musicians just starting out, while some of the best veterans made being in it for the long haul sound like the most rewarding journey imaginable.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. We first broadcast this piece earlier in December, before George Michael died of heart failure at the age of 53 on Christmas Day. So we went back to Ken and asked how he'd describe Michael's importance, and he said, Michael blended soul and pop without watering down either element, and sang that blend with more depth of feeling than we expect from most pop stars. Here's the George Michael song Ken wanted us to play.
I gotta have
We also lost some great jazz musicians this year, including singers Ernestine Anderson and Kay Starr, saxophonists Gatto Barbieri and Joe Temperley, pianists Connie Crothers and Sir Charles Thompson, clarinetist Pete Fountain, flutist Jeremy Steig, harmonica player Toots Thielsman. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers a few other musicians who died this year.
Vibraphonist Bobby Hutcherson in 1963 with Bob Cranshaw on bass, recorded by engineer Rudy Van Gelder. We lost all three of them in 2016. Hutcherson, one of the grand masters of the vibes, Bob Cranshaw, Sonny Rollins' longtime bassist of choice, and Rudy Van Gelder, who over five decades recorded more classic jazz albums than anyone at his home studios in New Jersey. Bobby Hutcherson could sound radically clanky early on with Eric Dolphy, though he spent more time exploring the vibe's fluid, lyrical, and bluesy side. But he never forgot vibraphone as a percussion instrument. Bobby Hutcherson in 2007. Another jazz musician with a deep blues sense who died this year is Mose Allison. He grew up near but not in Mississippi's blues-drenched Delta region, anticipating his musical style. Not pure blues, but in the neighborhood. Allison had started out as an economical band pianist, but when he started singing his songs, his career took off. His label promoted him as the Jazz Sage.
Talking. Don't ask me what I'm gonna do. The things I say at midnight, I might not say in daylight. I've reached a firm conclusion, it only breeds confusion. So don't call me, Daddy, I'll call you.
Mose Allison's lyrics were wryly funny and well observed. In the 60s, he influenced a few English rock bands, fellow white musicians looking to connect with black music. The Yardbirds did I'm Not Talkin', and The Who did his Young Man Blues. Allison mined the same vein ever after with self-deprecating wit.
I don't claim to be so great. I'm no pace setter, no fashion plate. I got some kids, I got a wife. I'm just trying to swing my way through life. So don't try to make me what I'm not. I'll just get by with what I've got. Live, let live, that's my advice. If you've got questions, ask me nice.
Mose Allison in 2009. Another pianist who came at the blues obliquely passed early this year, Montreal-born Paul Blais. He was playing bebop piano in Los Angeles in the 50s when he crossed paths with saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Ornette wrote catchy, bluesy tunes, but his band might wander off and into another key when they improvised. That was tough on pianists who weren't sure what to play and support. Blais' solution was to treat piano more like a horn, improvising lines and leaving the backing chords alone. Here he is in 1962. Paul Blais' linear flights made his sound light and airy, even when his solos got busy. He apparently made an impression on Herbie Hancock, who once literally sat on one hand while recording with Miles Davis. Blais' free-floating breeziness also influenced another pianist drawn to Ornette's flexible blues, the young Keith Jarrett. This is Blais in 64. In 2016, we lost musicians representing Dixieland, bebop, and the avant-garde, including one player who blurred those styles together, exuberant trumpeter Paul Smoker. To play this year's honor roll off the stage, here's Smoker's take on a very early stylization of the blues, W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. The greats pass away, but their music lives on. That's why they're the greats.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne Riebel Donato, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.